The American POTUS Podcast is a 501c3 nonprofit show supported by listener patriots just like you. To help us keep the program going, please join others around the nation by considering a tax-deductible donation. You can make your contribution and see what exciting plans we have for new podcasts and other outreach programs at AmericanPOTUS.org. Thank you for your support, and we hope you enjoy this episode. Coming up on American POTUS, Harry Truman and the atomic bomb. Nearly 80 years after, there are still countless questions surrounding this accidental president and his debatable decision to end the war with Japan in this explosive way. What were the political circumstances at the time, the estimates of casualties, the legacy it would leave with the rest of the world? And critically, after all was said and done, would dropping the bomb ironically end up saving lives for both sides? Vice President turned President Harry Truman and his decision to drop the atomic bomb. It's on this episode of American POTUS. I'm Scott Brun. With the help of presidential scholar Alan Lowe, we're opening the book on the men who have held our nation's highest office. By sharing their challenges, their stories, and their personalities, we hope to add some clarity and perspective for today's heated political conversations. Joining us for this episode about our 33rd POTUS and his decision to use the atomic bomb is author D.M. Giangreco. He served as an editor of the Military Review for the U.S. Army Command and General Staff College for 20 years. He's also the award-winning author or co-author of 14 books on military and socio-political subjects, including the book we want to get into today called Truman and the Bomb. We'll have a link to all of his amazing work on AmericanPOTUS.org. Dennis, welcome to the podcast. We're glad you're here.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
Dennis, great to talk to you again. Thanks so much for joining us. I really enjoyed Truman and the Bomb.
Well, it was a fun critter to put together.
Well, you know, one thing, you start the book by talking about Truman and his knowledge or lack of knowledge about the bomb when he assumed the presidency. I think most of us have heard the story through the years that he knew nothing about it. And even in his memoirs, he said he didn't know anything about it until he became president upon FDR's death. But you say that wasn't the case. Why do you believe that was not the case?
Oh, well, essentially because of the documents over at the Harry S. Truman Library. I hope it doesn't eat up too much of the podcast time, but that question, because the answer is completely different from what historians think they know, it requires a fairly comprehensive answer. Now, although Truman had a deep knowledge of both military affairs, particularly the armies, and prosecution of the war on the home front, he had almost no knowledge at all of foreign affairs beyond what he avidly read in the newspapers and picked up in, you know, the Senate. Plus, President Roosevelt had shared little, if anything, with him regarding his foreign policy goals and their relationship to military policy. So after Roosevelt's death, the newly minted commander-in-chief immediately initiated a crash course on the current state of U.S. foreign policy, in which he was closely tutored by the Roosevelt advisors, that top advisors that he trusted the most. Well, Truman's statements that you just mentioned about his knowledge, or reputedly the lack of knowledge regarding the atomic bomb, was in line with the overall situation he found himself in during that first month in office, and presented a clear, uncomplicated story. I don't know. I know nothing. Anyway, though Truman could have mentioned in his memoirs, and as his Secretary of State Jimmy Burns carefully noted, that he knew of the atomic bomb development generally through his Senate investigating committee he chaired, the editor of Truman's private papers, Robert Farrell, suggested to me that the president may have felt that after more than a decade of steadfastly maintaining to his Senate colleagues and even the civilian members of his committee that he knew absolutely nothing about the details of the Manhattan Project, that Truman, quoting Farrell, was in a box of his own making, end quote, and that the best thing to do was elaborate no further, especially since his prior knowledge of the atom bomb's development, quote, had no impact at all on the actual decision to use it against Japan. Now, some recognition had developed early on among scholars that Truman must have known more than he admitted. And then around 1990, I and several others were tipped off by archivist Dennis Bilger at the Truman Library that Truman's knowledge of the bomb is revealed in his own carefully worded July 1943 letter to a former Senate colleague. Now, while intriguing, and I've used that, and I'd used that that letter to Schwellenberg, it actually left open the question of exactly how much he came to know by the time he was sworn in 2 years later. Now, that answer is that question was answered quite by accident about 15 years later when I was researching Truman's military career for the book The Soldier from Independence. Volume 1 is currently out. Volume 2 will be out around a year from now. But in any event, I didn't really feel that my then current projects were the right place to put this this info and quote from it and so forth. So I held the material until I was finally able to get it into the book you read, Truman and the Bomb. Now, what I came across when researching for his on his military career was correspondence between the army officers assigned as liaisons to his investigating committee, Brigadier General Frank Lowe and Lieutenant Colonel Harry Vaughn. And that correspondence revealed that this close trio of three reserve officer artillerymen, Truman, Lowe, and Vaughn, quote, discussed the fissuring of the atom. This is from one of the letters. Discussed the fissuring of the atom many times in 1942 and 43, end quote. And Lowe had even touched on the matter with Truman as early as 1941. This all, of course, was top secret. And when Congress was awakened to the existence of the mysterious Manhattan Project in 1943, Truman, as is well known, was personally sworn to secrecy by Secretary of War Henry Stimson and both his fellow senators with knit brows beating on his door, and his civilians on his own staff were kept in the dark. It was a very delicate situation that Truman was in, and it persisted until he left the committee chairmanship upon joining the 1944 ticket with Roosevelt. Later, upon becoming president, he was given official and semi-official briefings on the bomb's development, in which he quite frankly played dumb. President's staff that he had suddenly inherited was not his own. And as far as they knew, Truman had little knowledge of the project, let alone its details. Now, there is no hint in the writings of the individuals who briefed the new president that he expressed any special knowledge of what was going on, only that he listened attentively and apparently asked good questions. These men, it must be remembered, worked for the president, not the other way around. And for Truman, it may simply have been a matter of seeing who would say what to their new boss. The account of these meetings appearing, the accounts, plural, of these meetings appearing as they did in Truman's own memoirs, and fitting nicely into Roosevelt's well-known method for managing and manipulating friends and foes alike, made Truman's claim of ignorance seem perfectly plausible and became, as you noted, a fundamental element of the atomic bomb story, setting the tone for much of the subsequent analysis of how the unprepared, quote, accidental president dealt with the crushing responsibilities of this new office. But like I mentioned earlier, I have to agree with Farrell, because we talked about this and this subject off and on literally for years, that the president may have felt that after more than a decade of maintaining that he knew absolutely nothing about the Manhattan Project, that he was in that box of his own making that Farrell referred to, and that the best thing to do was elaborate no further. Because again, his knowledge of its development had no impact, none, on the decision to use it against Japan. The bottom line is that Truman had considerable knowledge of the Manhattan Project long before Hiroshima and had engaged in a very careful sidetracking of fellow senators and his own staff's desire for a formal inquiry by his Senate Investigating Committee. The details of this, which you've read already, are covered in the chapter, The Manhattan Project, What Did Truman Know and When Did He Know It? And in associated appendices, principally Appendix D, The Manhattan Project, A Chronology of Congressional Investigation and Discovery, and Appendix E, Major General Frank Lowe to Brigadier General Harry Vaughn, quote, between you, the boss, and me, end quote.
Well, this shows what research can do, Dennis. It's very impressive. Again, kind of turning that story on its head that we've heard for so many years. But we know now, of course, when Truman goes in, he's given these estimates of what it's going to take to finish the war in Japan in terms of an invasion. I know in our previous conversations, I've told you my father was on a ship ready to be part of that invasion force. So without going into the casualty issue right away, we know that's a contentious thing. When Truman was first briefed, what were the estimates of the number of troops it would take for an invasion of Japan to be successful in that invasion?
Well, the massive two-phase invasion of Japan in 45 and 46 would ultimately require more than 3.5 million soldiers, sailors, and Marines taking part directly or indirectly in combat operations, plus another 1.5 million Americans providing direct support in the Western Pacific. Now, much of this force was not even in the Pacific yet. The U.S. First Army, which had pummeled its way from Normandy to the heart of Germany, and the 8th Air Force based in England were on the way as well, and the complex, minutely planned redeployment to the Pacific saw, the first of a planned 20 American combat divisions pulled from the line. In March, one of these formations, the 95th Infantry Division, it received its marching orders for an about-face west literally on the day Truman's second day in office. Now, as far as what Truman was given, he had seen a certain amount of these numbers before, I think you're going to be asking me about Hoover in a little bit, but what he was specifically told at the June 18 meeting, where he gave the thumbs up to the invasion itself, the first of the two invasion operations, was that we were going to be putting basically about 750,000 men onto mainland Japan within about the first 30 days.
We know that ever since the invasion did not happen, the casualty numbers that were anticipated have been a real contentious issue. So what are the estimates? What were the estimates of American and Japanese, both combatant and non-combatant casualties, if that invasion, those invasions had occurred?
First, I should mention that the draft, which had been ramped up to maintain a 100,000 men per month replacement stream for casualties during just the opening invasion operation, they were preparing logistic and medical infrastructure to handle, quote, 750,000 dead and evacuated wounded. The Army, for the most part, has to be, Army planners have to be judged kicking and screaming to make estimates at a strategic losses beyond, you know, a fairly short period of time. They just, because they can be wildly wrong. But on the logistics side, they have to look at being able to handle it and handle it month by month by month. Now, strategic estimates were being made, and Marshall was apparently at Potsdam, gave Truman a figure of like anywhere from a quarter million, you might call that the best case scenario, U.S. casualties, to a million. So that which would be, I guess, the worst case. So going from Marshall, you've got a quarter million to a full million. And that full million, for what it's worth, while it sounds crazy, it sounds like just absurdly huge. You got to remember that most of the million and a quarter all causes casualties from the war through say Okinawa and the surrender of Germany, basically about 1 million of that one and a quarter some million all causes casualties happened in just basically a 12-month period. It happened really from say June of 1944, from with the invasion of Normandy and the invasion of the Mariana Islands, through the end of the war in Europe and Okinawa. As a practical matter, those not that, you know, when you say a million casualties, it sounds just, you know, how do you get your head around it? But as a practical matter, that's exactly what they had already been looking at. This was not the end of the war, as we now know. It was viewed as the middle of the war. In terms of getting a grip on what we were going to be having to do in terms of, you know, Japan, while about 5 million Germans were projected to have been killed in the war so far, it was estimated that, like, we were going to be having to, and these were estimates going to Stimson. Don't know if Truman saw these, but we know they went to Stimson because he's the one who instituted the study. It was estimated that we might have to kill 10 to 20 million Japanese, or approximately, depending on how you want to count the Japanese population, because a lot of them were in mainland China. That up to 20 million is essentially a quarter of the Japanese on the main islands themselves. So and we were going to be having to like fix that situation and support the remaining population after the war for an unknown period of time. So, you know, the numbers that were being looked at are so astronomically huge. Again, how do you even get your hands around them, so to speak, your brain around it?
You mentioned former President Hoover earlier. Can you elaborate perhaps a bit on his role in advising Truman on the war?
He had asked Hoover after their meeting to submit a series of memorandums on the things that they had discussed. And one of the things that they discussed happened to be the casualty issue as it related to, you know, United States losses. And it was in the memorandum, again, requested by Truman himself. It was in memorandum 4 that by that incurable number cruncher Hoover, that he spelled out in clear English that the invasion of Japan could cost 500,000 to 100,000 American lives. And, you know, gosh, there's, you can find again in the Truman Library, this memorandum number 4 containing Truman's notation identifying the author of the unsigned memorandum, because none of them did he have his name on it, but identifying it as being Hoover himself. And so Truman is hearing these astronomical numbers from certainly more than one source, because again, you know, you're working off of the experience of the war thus far.
Now, Dennis, you know, I hear so often, and I want to refer them to your book when I hear this, so many people saying that Truman rushed to use the bomb to keep the Soviets out of the Pacific War. But you show, I think, again, with really good research, that's not the case. Can you tell our listeners just a bit of why you believe that was not the case?
That had been a line going back to literally in the New York Times the day before the Nagasaki bomb was even dropped. I mean, this is a line that goes way back and has been popularized in like relatively recent times, in the frequently referenced book Racing the Enemy, which postulates that the U.S. and the Soviets were engaged in some kind of, quote, race to defeat Japan. In reality, there was indeed a race of sorts involving the United States and the Soviet Union in the Far East, but it was a race by both allies to get the Soviet Red Army into the war against Japan as quickly as possible. In October 44, Stalin, after detailed planning by the Soviet General Staff, provided to U.S. representatives what supplies they needed for offensive rather than fundamentally defensive operations. Woof, woof. Yeah, and again, we're talking here, you know, well before the Yalta Conference, almost a year before these discussions in Moscow, where the Soviet Army's needs were being presented, almost a year before at Tehran, Stalin had surprised his Western allies by opening the conference with the statement that the Soviet Union would join them in their war against Japan after Germany's capitulation. He now reiterated that his Tehran pledge was not quote, not empty words, and remarked that the U.S. and Soviet strategic plans were, quote, in coordination. The United States would strike at the industrial heart of Japan while the Soviet Union would, quote, break Japan's spine. There's another variation of the Stalin's quote, because there were numerous, there was actually two reports that went to Roosevelt. One had it break the Japanese spine, and the other was break the back of Japan. Either way, it's the same thing. Let's see. So Stalin maintained that if stores could be built up now, the attack could be made 2 to 3 months after Germany's collapse, and stated that that planning should begin at once. Now, throughout the Yalta and Potsdam conferences, as well as all the Moscow negotiations before and between them, the Soviets never deviated from this timetable, which would serve as the basis for all military-to-military coordination between the two powers and an immediate jump in lend-lease deliveries to the Soviet Union, even though it would not be formally codified until months later at the Yalta Conference, the following year. And this secret, this was a whole utterly secret military ministered lend lease program. It was not, this was not done through the normal channels. And I'm trying to think about a simple way to put this. It was so massive in scale that it was requiring ultimately Lend-Lease deliveries going through reflagged American Liberty ships and Victory ships sailing through Japanese straits, with under the Soviet flag. The crews were drawn from the port, the port cities, to man these vessels, included sailors from really any nations that were available, because they were sailing under the Soviet flag. It's real common in shipping. But interestingly enough, portions of these crews were also American sailors. So you've got Americans under a Soviet flag sailing through Japanese straits to Vladivostok. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating that this was going on. But the simple fact of the matter is that the Trans-Siberian Railroad just could not, it could get the men across from Europe to the Far East, but in the short time available, it could not get the supplies there. So most of what you see in the Soviet invasion of Manchuria, the bulk of that equipment that you see is in fact Lend-Lease supplies that were cranked out across the Pacific in a fairly narrow time frame to ready the Soviet army for this operation. Because really, to launch an operation of this type so quickly, where again, it's not something just to keep the Japanese occupied, but literally defeat them. Because one of the things that was worried about is if it was just a half-hearted or well-intentioned operation run on just the Soviet manpower and supplies in the Far East, it might tend to, instead of destroying the Japanese, push them back towards the ports where they could much more successfully than the U.S. Navy would like to admit withdraw to the home islands. So the Stalin talked about this, as well as the military chiefs in Moscow. So the idea was to crush the Japanese army, not just push it back or engage it.
So, another argument we often hear today is that a Japanese surrender could have been achieved by conventional means. The firebombing of Tokyo and so forth. Is there any indication that could have been the case? And we also kind of related to that here, that Japan was very near to surrendering at the time. Is there any truth? Did you find any proof of that in your research?
I mean, hey, if it goes down to the core of the question, we could win the war. That was not really how it was looked upon. We could win a war without the atomic bomb, or the atomic bombs. And in fact, we were planning to do it. The question, however, is how long is it going to take? And what is going to be the ultimate cost if you engage a favorite thing of critics, a favorite line of critics of, the atomic bomb and of Truman is that, well, we could have engaged in a blockade and bombardment. Absolutely true. Although it is important to note that was already what we were doing. The blockade and bombardment, the bombardment started as early as, the B-29 raids, which were, killing hundreds of thousands of Japanese, almost 100,000 in Tokyo itself in one night, and displacing ultimately 8 million Japanese. We could certainly just continue doing something like that. But the thing is again, how long does it take? And will the military, and does the military junta ruling Japan at the time, do they particularly care? A famous line being used and pushed out to the population in Japan, which was being mobilized all the way from young high school girls to like elderly old men, was a diamond smashing to a million pieces, you know, like a beautiful jewel smashed to a million pieces in defense of the emperor. So they themselves were looking at casualties running up into enormous numbers. There, I'm going to have to make a correction on an earlier statement. We were looking at having to possibly kill 10 million Japanese. The 20 million figure that I mistakenly attributed to the U.S. earlier, that was actually from that was actually what was being briefed within imperial sources when they were discussing the future war, that they would have to probably suffer 20 million casualties in order to win the war ultimately. And the source of this was from a general officer interrogations and also the Tokyo war crimes trials. So while we in the United States are briefing Stimson to maybe 10 million Japanese, and then we're also going to have to pick up the pieces and feed the population after the war, the Japanese leadership is actually looking at a figure double that, which they were quite prepared to suffer. It is a very different mindset, and a mindset that is hard for people today to really come to grips with. But it is, in modern terms, it is probably closest to the closest thing in modern terms would probably be the mindset of, say, ISIS, when their expansion was going on in the Middle East in fairly recent times before they were finally suppressed.
So what credence do you give to the kind of hindsight looking back now of saying, well, the Japanese were preparing to surrender, or perhaps we should not have demanded unconditional surrender, and that was prolonging the war? What do you think about those criticisms of President Truman and his administration?
Well, you know, the interesting thing is, and I wish I had the quote in front of me, but Herbert Bix, in his book, Pulitzer-winning book on Hirohito, basically said that that was nonsense. There was no movement within Japan for any kind of a softening of terms, because from the standpoint of the Japanese leadership, keeping the imperial throne in operation and in existence was only a piece of what they wanted. Among other things, they wanted to be able to decide who they were going to be offering up for any subsequent war crimes trials, and the offering up would not be themselves, you know, but like probably select underlings. They also did not and were refusing to entertain the idea of giving up their holdings on the Asian mainland. There were vague hopes that they could get the Soviets to come in and, say, negotiate something. But the Soviets themselves, were already part of the end game with twin invasions happening within a very short time span of each other. The United States going at Japan's head, the Soviets going at Japan's spine, the industrial heartland of Manchuria. So, you know, the interesting thing is one wonders just how serious the Japanese were when they approached the Soviets. They did approach the Soviets in a very vague proposal that one of the princes go to Moscow for negotiations with the Soviets, but there was nothing concrete to it. And the Soviets, you know, themselves said, well, there's nothing concrete to this. And we were actually reading the Japanese mail to use a quote of Stimson's, because we had broken their codes, and we were reading both their we were intercepting and translating both their diplomatic communications and their military communications. There was no sign at all that the so-called peace party that Stimson and a few others hoped existed was really anywhere in evidence. And of course, interestingly enough, even when the emperor did finally just essentially order a halt, there was a coup against him, and that was only put down with some difficulty. So the idea that the Japanese were angling to surrender is not supported by their internal communications that both the Soviets were seeing and that we were seeing. It was viewed in both Moscow and Washington as really an attempted stalling tactic. Now, of course, in modern times, what Moscow and the United States viewed as stalling tactics is looked upon as a serious effort. You know, even though they are just, they are about as vague proposals as you could possibly get. There was nothing concrete to them. We're going to send a representative to discuss ways. Well, what does that mean? There was nothing going on, in that matter. And even someone who is a critic of Truman, such as Bix, is very clear about that. What else can you say?
Yeah,
we were reading their mail and knew it was fake.
Yeah. So in the final analysis, given the conditions he faced, given the casualty numbers he was being quoted, do you think Truman's approval of using the bomb was a foregone conclusion?
Really, I don't see any way myself that he could have done anything else. At the time, we're looking at a replacement stream, and then again, we'd upped the draft while Roosevelt was still very much alive, and the victory over the Nazis was like immediately on the very immediate horizon, in spite of the fact that the war in Europe was about to be wrapping up. Purely for the ramping up of casualty replacement, we over a several month period at the beginning of 1945 upped the draft calls from 60,000 to 80,000 to 100,000 men a month. And when you add in the increased draft calls for the Marines and the Navy, we were attempting to bring into the service begin the process of bringing in month by month into the armed services 140,000 men per month. And that's even with bringing the 8th Army over from Europe, and the 1st Army and the 8th Air Force over from Europe to the Pacific. Because as a practical matter, we did not have enough men and material in the Pacific to carry it off. We could do the initial invasion operation against Japan principally with the manpower already in the Pacific, although about 400,000 engineers were deemed to be necessary, and they had the highest priority getting the engineers, engineer units, not the combat divisions or the Air Force, but getting engineer units out there. For the second invasion operation in the Tokyo area in the spring of 1946, because again, we thought we were in the middle of the war, not at the end of the war. Most of what you see coming over from Europe and from the draft was actually ultimately geared towards the buildup for the second invasion operation. We thought this was going to be going on really for years more. The sardonic phrase, the black humor in the Pacific was the Golden Gate in 48. That's when, you know, like the troops that survived would finally be getting back to the United States. Yeah, the Golden Gate in 48. Which includes your father.
That's right. That's right. And I'm certainly glad he made it back so I could be talking to you today. And I will say, you know, let's jump to my final question for you here in the interest of time, Dennis, is the influence of this experience with Truman and his approval of the use of the bomb and his later approval for the development of the hydrogen bomb. How do you think those two experiences were related and affected the earlier affected Truman's decision to proceed with the latter?
With the hydrogen bomb, that is not a subject that I have done deep study in. I can tell you, however, from the movie Oppenheimer, that one of the things that struck me when watching that particular film was that while in the first half of the movie, the need to develop the atomic bomb was referred to, and in some cases quite forcefully, as being an absolute necessity in order to potentially save vast numbers of American lives. That was very forcefully presented in the first half of the film, and I think well presented. What was interesting, though, about the second half of the film, where you had very McCarthy-esque inquisition of Oppenheimer and that was going on, is while I believe that he personally was treated very unfairly, you had the United States government or elements of it very much in panic mode at that particular time. There had been, let's recount what is not shown in Oppenheimer during that time frame in which that Inquisition was taking place. You had as Churchill called it, the falling of an iron curtain across the middle of Europe. You had the two most visible at the time examples of that being the forcible takeover of the Czechoslovakian government, and also the cutoff of West Berlin and the Berlin airlift. So you've got the Iron Curtain with events in Czechoslovakia and the Berlin blockade and airlift. You have the fall of China, which stunned a lot of people in the United States. You have the advent of the Korean War. You have the Soviet Union getting the atomic bomb and the development of the hydrogen bomb. there's a lot of things going on that are background to that panic and inquisition really would have informed viewers of that movie much more clearly. I know that there were insinuations, but I don't know that it was very clearly stated that the American atomic program had been infiltrated by Soviet spy rings. I think it was insinuated, but not actually specifically dealt with in any kind of detail. That was that, and the development of the Soviet atomic bomb were a very, very, very big deal. I do remember at one point in the movie where one of the army investigators did kind of touch on the matter that the Soviets may have been more than a disinterested party who was owed the atomic secrets, and that they were more than just nice guys looking to increase their knowledge for peaceful development. When an individual, a scientist on the periphery of Oppenheimer's circle, when it was noted that they should really interrogate him, perhaps using Russian methods. I think with the exception of that one phrase in the entire movie, in to possibly interrogate this guy using Russian methods, that's really not dealt upon at all in the movie. The raw fear that underlaid all of this at the time. So yeah, it's completely missing from that second half of the movie. They get the first half with a very high degree of accuracy, and as far as the Inquisition itself, as far as my limited knowledge goes, it looks pretty accurate. But as far as what was underpinning it, yeah, not even touched on.
So, my final statement, I'll turn it over to Scott, is that my question, if I'd been there and talking to Oppenheimer, which I never would have been in the same circles, but if I was, the genie was out of the bottle. So I think for President Truman, from my perspective, the decision is, if you're told by noted scientists that the development of the hydrogen bomb is going to happen, that the knowledge is out, eventually it will happen. The question is, who develops it first and who has that ability? I'd much rather for us to have it than the Soviets, as you say, at that point, taking over great swaths of Europe and showing itself to be a totalitarian power and so forth. But certainly,
and with their development of the atomic bomb as quickly, I have to stress this, at the time, the speed at which they developed it, I don't know to how much with the assistance of spies, but that was certainly a big part of the fear. And but I myself couldn't tell you how much the stealing of atomic secrets entered into it. But I can tell you that the speed at which they developed it really had people on both sides of the aisle in the United States in a panic.
And I guess the statement would be, even if they had developed that knowledge on their own, knowing if we did not develop the hydrogen bomb ever, if that was put on hiatus here, permanently, at some point the Soviets would be under no such restrictions. So at some point they would have a weapon that is so massively larger than the atomic bomb, it would not be good for our republic. But that is my personal view. And with that, Scott, I'm pontificating now. I'm going to turn it over to you.
Well, continuing down this topic, Dennis, what light can you cast on the relationship of Truman and Oppenheimer?
I think their relationship is within a certain degree, fairly accurate with how it is portrayed, except that they have Truman being somewhat, of a buffoon, which of course is something that goes back in the historiography, all the way back to the post-World War II period. His enemies at the time portrayed him as indeed, in that manner, going way back. There are so many examples of that in the historical record on like how Truman was portrayed. He would joke, and I could see people not getting a joke, but by the same token, it was so well known that he would joke. And politicians do make some politicians more than others and make extreme statements. You know, you got, it's hard for me to say what their relationship was beyond the crybaby stuff that came out, because Truman was seeing a lot of that at the time. He was seeing it from a whole strata of his critics, you know, the wringing of the hands and the quick forgetting of the casualties. In many ways, you could say that like the horrifying U.S. casualties during the war, especially in that compressed into that last year of it, was pretty much just kind of more or less forgotten at the time. The U.S. Army was downplaying the casualties and only reporting narrow facets of it for, you know, their own purposes. And it was not really realized until you take a look at the broad picture just how large the casualties were and how compressed they were. You see the large numbers of our British Empire allies and the Chinese and the Russians, and you know it was going to be continuing to go on. There was the UN's figures that were compiled. I forget the agency. I'd have to look it up in my own book. But the UN figures after the war was that in the Far East, from Indonesia through Manchuria, something like, and again, how do you wrap your head around this? Something like 400,000 people were dying each and every month that the war went on. And it was beyond the eyes of Americans. This is going on in places where there are no Americans. It's going on in Indonesia. It's going on in Vietnam, principally the northern portion of Vietnam. It's going on in spades in China, and of course the actual fighting. Oh, this is all, by the way, due to exposure, malnutrition, you know, things along those lines. And part of that also was actual combat. You have the losses due to the firebombings in Japan itself, 100,000 in one night in Tokyo, and with the burning out of every major Japanese city, with the exception of those being saved for the nuclear target set, you know, which were not included in that. You got 100,000 in the month and a half long fighting in Manila, where Japanese were engaging in mass executions of Melanese who were in their area of control. Then you have, of course, Okinawa, where the fighting rolled over them, and somewhere between 40,000 and perhaps as many, in some figures, 100,000, you know, were killed. So you have, you know, hundreds of thousands in the fighting itself. You have hundreds of thousands largely unseen in this giant arc, you know, running along the Western Pacific. And, you know, the longer that war went on, it was just going to keep coming.
Well, this kind of leads to my next question. Unlike many presidents we've had, Truman actually knew the horrors of war firsthand, serving as an officer in World War I. Do you think that experience came into play when deciding to use the weapon?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, that's my first book, which is out now, of the two-volume Soldier from Independence. Truman's artillery. Most people think of Truman in World War I in terms of the sanitized letters that he sent to his wife, Bess, and they were highly sanitized. Myself and Farrell, who I mentioned earlier, he'd had a bestseller called Dear Bess. You know, we talked about that a lot. But people remember him from World War One as having, you know, a certain amount of combat. But really, he's this guy who ran a canteen over, you know, in Fort Sill down there at the Army camp, you know, for the training of the 35th Division. Now, in fact, Truman was a real aggressive guy. Truman was given command of a unit that had a lot of problems and whipped those guys into shape. He wondered if he didn't get them into shape, if he was going to be sent back, banished from France and sent back to the United States. But he did. He whipped them into shape, and they were top-notch artillerymen. During the Meuse-Argonne offensive, his unit ultimately was situated in what was referred to by a neighboring unit as a cemetery of unburied dead. The main communications line bringing prisoners back from the front line right in front of him ran immediately to the left of his battery, and so they saw all that too. Where they had their horses, staying, there were German bodies all over that particular area. The 35th Division, of which he was a member, saw the highest, the fastest high casualty rate of any particular unit in the AEF. And the unit that replaced them on the front line, the 1st Infantry Division, then was in the repeat situation. There was something like 17,000 casualties in an area probably about as big as like many major college campuses, because it was a very compressed front. And Truman, to kind of help rectify this situation, disobeyed orders and was threatened with courts-martial because when he saw German artillery batteries setting up on his left flank, because the division on his combat division on his left flank couldn't keep up, and so the Germans were able to put 16 batteries into that area altogether. When he saw one of them being set up, he fired out of sector and forced the permanent abandonment of that battery. The next day, in spite of threats of court-martial, but with the okay from his battalion commander, who, you know, supported him in this, Truman did it again. He took out another German artillery battery that he saw, you know, getting ready to get on the move, and a very, very important German observation post. So Truman was a very gutsy guy for certain political reasons, principally having to do with him being a National Guardsman at the time. He was not given a regular army officer would have probably been decorated for this. He was not. Instead, what the army did after the war is he left the army, but only briefly. And they said, you come back in and we're going to reinstate you as a major. So while every other officer from General Marshall to General Patton, while every other officer is being put retrograde to their pre-war ranks, he is being brought back in at a promotion. And he ultimately rose to colonel of one artillery regiment and then another one. He rose to full colonel before he even became a senator. This is missing, by the way, from virtually every frigging history of Truman. And I've talked with David McCullough about this. I've talked with Hamby. I've talked with Bob Farrell. And it's just amazing. It's just not part of the historical record. But it is also the subject of The Soldier from Independence, which takes his military career up through the pre-World War II period, where he is being a senior observer on some of the big exercises as the Army transitions to mechanization. I mean, Truman, far from being this ignorant bump on a log who was a former battery captain, that's like saying Napoleon's a former battery captain. He knew everybody. And so he came in with vastly more experience, an experience of having commanded a battery in a cemetery of unburied dead, than most people, again, could ever imagine.
Dennis, this whole conversation has been really, really interesting. I know you mentioned this book that you have out now. What's next for you? Are you working on anything new, something new on the horizon?
Well, it is volume two of The Soldier from Independence. There was, of course, Hell to Pay, which went into paperback and went into then an expanded edition, which also then itself went into to paperback. Hell to Pay sales are still very, very strong. There was the original Soldier from Independence that then went into paperback as well, and it's out now. Yeah, that's The Soldier from Independence, and that's volume one. And about a year from now, you'll be seeing it. Now, that first volume goes up through when he musters out in 1919. The next volume takes it from 1919 into really up to the period of the Truman Committee. So that will be the next critter that'll be coming out. But right now you have Truman and the Bomb.
Well, we look forward to it, and we will have links to all these great titles on AmericanPotus.org so you can find them and purchase them and read them for yourself. Dennis, thank you so much for taking time to be on the podcast. We hope you had a good time.
Well, I sure did.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the American POTUS Podcast. We'd like to thank author D.M. Giangreco for joining us on this episode about Harry Truman. More information about his terrific book can easily be found on AmericanPOTUS.org. And we would like to thank all of you that have made a tax-deductible financial contribution to support this podcast. In addition to this show, your generosity helps us develop new groundbreaking podcast shows and revolutionary outreach programs, offering clarity and perspective to today's political conversations. If you'd like to contribute, it's easy. Simply visit AmericanPOTUS.org. We appreciate your help. American POTUS is produced by American History Studios. Graphic design by Proudler Design, and original music score by Jonathan Clark Music. Finally, it's our presidential last word from Harry Truman, quote, "The atom bomb was no great decision. It was merely another powerful weapon in the arsenal of righteousness."